nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay. All right. So we're very fortunate to have Professor Woodall with us today. Professor Woodall is a distinguished professor at Purdue. And he's an electrical engineer, but he's a pioneer in the field of compound semiconductor materials and devices. He spent most of his career at IBM Research, where he did that work, for which he's well known. He's received almost every prize and award that there is. And in 2001, President Bush awarded him the National Medal of Technology. And I want to read to you the citation so you can see what he did. He won that award for the invention and development of technologically and commercially important compound semiconductor heterojunction materials, processes, and related devices, such as light-emitting diodes, lasers, ultra-fast transistors, and solar cells. So every time you listen to a CD or use a laser pointer, you're using some technology that he invented. Now, I think he's not going to talk about that today, but I think he's going to talk about some work that actually sprung from some of that compound semiconductor research. So please join me in welcoming Professor Woodall.
Oh, thank you, Mark. That was a great introduction. So there's not much in the way of electrical engineering in this title. At least it doesn't seem to be, but there really is. ECE school now has an energy component, and so as time goes on and on, there's going to be more and more careers in the field of energy, and it's cross-disciplinary. And so it turns out that even though I did a lot of my work on compound semiconductors, part of the work that led to the compound semiconductor stuff was the genesis of what I'm going to talk about today. So everything that I'm going to talk about is in the title. We're talking about a bulk aluminum alloys. It's a high energy density material. I will tell you what those numbers are. For safe energy storage, transport, and splitting of water, not sodium hydroxide, just plain old tap water to make hydrogen. And the key thing here is on demand, so we don't have to store any hydrogen, because there are a lot of people who don't like to store hydrogen. There have been some past histories about the hydrogen, the Hindenburg and everything else. It turns out it was the paint on the Hindenburg that was the problem. The hydrogen didn't help either. Okay, so let me move forward with this. Let's see if this thing works. Yeah. So here, a lot of the people are doing all the work. You know how that goes. You're graduate students. So some professor stands up and talks about your work, although my students get to give conference papers. So Jeff Zebart, he's an electrical engineering student. Charles Allen is. Go Choi. They're all three electrical engineering students. Dr. Jiang is a research scientist who worked under me when I was here at Purdue before, and Professor Kramer up at Purdue Calumet, and Professor Debbie Sherman, who is over in the life sciences area. She's been doing a lot of the microscopy work that I'll mention today. So let's get started here. Let me tell you what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the energy density and technology sustainability of using aluminum. Now, this word sustainability is really important because you can always make a little bit of energy. There are a lot of people who can take garbage or manure out of the back and run their cars with it. But if you're talking about 100 quad, 100 10 to the 15th BTUs that the United States uses each year, a little manure is not going to do the trick, okay? So we're going to talk about energy density and the technology sustainability. I'm going to tell you a little bit of the brief history of the technology that Mark referred to. This was an accidental discovery in my laboratory when I was trying to make gallium aluminum arsenide, and I'll mention that again. We're going to say a little bit about what we know about the structure and reaction kinetics. And more interestingly, it's what we can use this stuff for, which we're still trying to evolve where it actually will fit. It reminds me of a skinned cow hanging in a butcher's office or a butcher's freezer, where you can get steaks out of it, you can get roasts and stuff like that. So we're still trying to figure out what part of the cow is useful for what it will do well. Okay, so we're going to talk about energy density and sustainability right now. So let's start with the numbers first. So we're going to talk about what aluminum can do. When you react aluminum with water, I'll show you the reaction. We're going to get H2 gas, we're going to get heat, and we're going to compare this stuff with diesel and liquid hydrogen and things like that. So let's start with hydrogen first. So a kilogram of hydrogen gas will give us 142 megajoules. This turns out to be almost 40 kilowatt hours of combustible energy. A kilogram of aluminum will make 111 grams of hydrogen and using 1 kilogram of water. That'll give us about 4.4 kilowatt hours of energy. A gallon of aluminum makes 44 kilowatt hours as hydrogen. A gallon of diesel makes 37 kilowatt hours of energy. And a gallon of liquid hydrogen is only 10 kilowatt hours of energy. So this is why if you want to go over to Munich and rent a BMW that has hydrogen, a big fancy car, you know, they're pushing this hydrogen car over there, they have decided to use liquid hydrogen. They store it in a Dewar, and if you park it overnight, 25% of it will have evaporated away by the morning. And it's got an 80-mile range with hydrogen, so in case you're out there in the countryside, you want to get home, there's a 16-gallon tank of gasoline in there also, and there's a little switch on the dashboard that allows you to switch from burning hydrogen back to gasoline in an internal combustion engine car. That's how it works. But it makes good PR, you know, hydrogen's clean, it's green, oh boy, oh boy. Okay, so, but the point is, the energy density of liquid hydrogen isn't very high. And the reason is, liquid hydrogen's not very dense. So the point is that even though hydrogen itself has a high energy density per unit weight, the density of liquid hydrogen is very light, so you don't get very much out of it. Now, either good news or bad news, the rest of the reaction of aluminum with water gives us heat, and about half of the energy that you get out, which is 8.6 kilowatt hours per kilogram of aluminum, comes out as heat. That's about 4.2 kilowatt hours per kilogram of aluminum. So the total energy is about 8.6 kilowatt hours. 1 kilogram of coal gives you about 6.7 kilowatt hours. So aluminum is better than coal. Coal is a hell of a lot cheaper, though. Energy to electrolyze aluminum, 1 kilogram of aluminum back to 1 kilogram of aluminum is 12.9 kilowatt hours. So the efficiency, hydrogen energy divided by the electrolysis of getting the aluminum from electrolyzing aluminum oxide, which is the stuff that comes out of the ground as in the form of bauxite, is only 34%. But that's not too bad because electrolysis is less than that. But it is a consideration when you are thinking about whether you're going to use aluminum. The bottom line that I hope to get across here is that if you have electricity, if you have it, don't degrade it. Use it. If we have an extension cord that would go from my house in West Point to the airport, I would use it. I would never use gasoline, but my extension cord is not that long. So you need something that the reason aluminum is going to be interesting is it's mobile. It's like a can of gasoline, or it's like coal. It's an energy storage material that you can use to convert to hydrogen. And once you have hydrogen and you have oxygen, you have a fuel. So let me tell you about aluminum. This is really interesting. So the bauxite that we use to make aluminum comes out of Australia and other places. Not too much in the Middle East, which is probably a good thing. No aspersion was intended in that, but we don't have to worry about where we find the aluminum oxide if we're going to use this. Of course, if it's really important, we might have problem with our neighbors that have this stuff. Alumina, which is aluminum oxide, is chemically purified to 4.9's purity. Now, it's really important. The business model is that in order to make aluminum, you have to purify the aluminum oxide to 4.9's purity. So then what you do is you size it into a powder with a mean particle size of about 120 microns. And if it's done by Alcoa in Australia, it is shipped to one of their 9 smelters around the world. When it gets there, they put this thing into an electrolysis process. They pass current using carbon electrodes. Yes, there's some CO2 that comes off of that. So if you were making Budweiser cans, you add 2.5% magnesium to it. If you're making engine blocks for Subaru, you add 2.5% silicon. So the point is that once I make these things, nobody wants them anymore after they've been used up. So the car that's in the junkyard that has an aluminum head or block just sits there because Alcoa doesn't want it because it costs more money to bring it back to 4.9's than it does to start with bauxite in the ground again. Got it? But I don't care about purity. So all the scrap aluminum metal with impurities is currently not recycled because it's cheaper to purify alumina, which is Al2O3, than impure aluminum. It's a key to what I'm going to talk about today in terms of sustainability. So here we got it. Sustainability. So the world supply of aluminum reserve means economically recoverable in the planet's crust is about 10 to the 13th kilograms as aluminum. Or if I convert to hydrogen, 1.2 times 10 to the 12th kilograms of hydrogen made by splitting water, that equals about 5 times 10 to the 13th kilowatt hours of hydrogen energy, okay? So there's enough there to make a big impact. Since the beginning of time, since about 1880, when aluminum was processed into alumina, was made into aluminum by a fellow by the name of Hall in the U.S. who started Alcoa, and a fellow by the name of Hero in France, there has been about 700 billion kilograms of aluminum made. Of that 700 billion, 400 billion of it are just lying around junkyards, scrap heaps. Now, I consider that good news because that's a lot of aluminum I don't even have to make from aluminum oxide. So that's enough aluminum. If we used all that to supply 12% of the U.S. annual energy consumption, which is about 100 quad is 10 to the 15th BTUs. So there's a lot of it, and it's sustainable. From my perspective, since the current world annual production is only 32 billion kilograms, this gives us a big inventory in which to give the aluminum companies a chance to start making increasing capacity so they can make more aluminum if this process or this technology will take off. So I consider that good news. For example, let's take fuel cell cars. So if we used only 200 billion kilograms of the scrap, who were dedicating that to splitting water, 25 billion kilograms of hydrogen could be made by splitting water. At 100 kilometers per kilogram, which is the GE target for their fuel cell car, which is their plan of record, at an efficiency of hydrogen efficiency, 2.5 times 10 to the 10th kilograms of hydrogen could power 100 million GM fuel cell cars for 25,000 kilometers. Now that's an impact. So we have something that's actually sustainable and reasonably important as far as large-scale use is concerned. All right, let's get on with the show. All right, so let's go back to my lab in 1968 at IBM. I was making gallium aluminum arsenide, epitaxial layers on gallium arsenide. So most of you in this room have probably heard of high mobility, heterojunction bipolar transistors and things like that. One of the components in the early ones, and they are still used, is that the emitter is made of gallium aluminum arsenide, a higher band gap material than gallium arsenide. So I was making this gallium aluminum arsenide by a technique called liquid phase epitaxy. Some of you may have heard that word before. It's a solution growth technique where you take a melt of gallium, you add some aluminum in it, you put a dopant in there, and you add some gallium arsenide as a source of arsenic. You heat this stuff up to about 800 degrees Celsius, stick a wafer in it, and cool it down, you get a nice layer of gallium aluminum arsenide. Very high quality. I won't go into the reasons for that in this lecture, but it comes out very pure to be done that way. So I was reusing the little crucibles that I was using to make this liquid phase epitaxy apparatus work, and I was washing out with warm deionized water of this the melt that's left over, which contains gallium and aluminum in it, and voila, you add water to it, I get this minor explosion in my face. Fortunately, I was wearing a face mask and heat coming out, so I was very surprised by that because I thought I just had a beaker, some stuff that was not going to be reactive with water. So I had to go back to my office and figure out what was going on. And after a couple hours, I figured it out. The aluminum in the gallium plus water, three waters, goes to three hydrogen, 3H2O, plus aluminum oxide plus heat. So let me say again how this works. So here's a demonstration of that process. So I got a kilogram of gallium in a crystallization dish here. I had a movie of that, but it takes a little bit too long to go. I have gallium, 100 kilogram of gallium, 25 grams of aluminum at 100 degrees C on a hot plate with a stir. After everything is dissolved, I lower the hot plate temperature to about 50 degrees C, and we add water, and we get the hydrogen. So 25 grams of aluminum will make 33 liters of hydrogen at standard temperature pressure, which is one atmosphere. And this thing bubbles. This reacts very fast. This is all reacted after a couple of minutes. So you want to stand back and do this in a hood. Don't do this at home, exactly, unless you have a chem hood there. So then, after 3 or 4 days, you let the water settle out, which is down the bottom here, you can't see. This white powder is aluminum oxide, stuff I can pass current through and make aluminum again from it. So now I have a recyclable process. I got hydrogen in it, and the water, the excess water I had left over, we'll just use or add more water to stuff that we've recycled. So how does this work? Well, if I take a piece of aluminum rod or anything, any shape, a boat, put it in water, nothing happens. And the reason nothing happens is aluminum loves oxygen. That's what makes it a high energy density material. So on the surface of every piece of aluminum in air, there's a very thin skin of Al2O3, alumina, and it protects the aluminum from further rapid oxidation. Unlike steel, which will continue to rust until the bridge collapses, we don't want that to happen, aluminum doesn't do that. It just sits there with a 20 or 30 nanometer thick film of aluminum oxide, and it's stable. However, if we remove this passivating oxide layer, the aluminum will react to produce water, and the reaction react with water to produce higher, just as I showed you. So the way we get rid of, in this particular early experiment at IBM, we got rid of this passivating oxide by dissolving the aluminum into the liquid gallium. So think of it. So here's this aluminum dissolved in there. I got a big matrix of liquid gallium. There's no solid surface anymore. So any aluminum atom at the surface of fibrin contact with water, the aluminum atom at the interface splits the water into hydrogen and aluminum oxide. So the aluminum oxide now floats away, and so I haven't passivated the aluminum. So the rest of the aluminum can either get there by convection or diffusion, just like you would diffuse carriers across a PN junction. The aluminum diffuses to the surface and continues to split water until the aluminum is all formed, goes into aluminum oxide, okay? That's how it works. So that's not a big mystery. So, clock goes forward. This sat around from 1968. We got a patent on it in 1980. So it's gathering dust. So when I was at Yale, I decided to take a look at it again, but not seriously until I came back to Purdue in 2005. So with a couple of students, we have now gone from gallium-rich liquids to solid bulk aluminous, 95% weight and 5% weight of a mixture of gallium, indium, and tin. Okay, so what's with that? Well, I'll tell you how it works in a minute. But the indium gallium 10 lowers the melting point of the alloy component, and that turns out to be very important. So this stuff will split water at temperatures between ice, 0 degrees C, and steam, greater than 100 degrees C, and make hydrogen on demand. So we've made a lot of progress. We've moved all the way across the phase diagram, if you will, from nearly pure gallium to now nearly pure aluminum. So let's take a look at that. Okay, so I didn't show you the phase diagram. I figured this is an electrical engineering course, so I won't throw phase diagrams at you, but it's a good thing to learn if you're going to be in the semiconductor business. So here's an example of some briquettes of our stuff, 28% weight aluminum. This is in the process of getting to 75. I just want to show you what it looks like. Here are some chunks. These are solid chunks of aluminum and gallium. The phase diagram predicts that there will be some liquid gallium floating around, but there doesn't seem to be unless you get it real hot. Then you can see the gallium bleed out of these samples. I'm just showing you some examples of what this stuff looks like. Here is a piece of our 95% aluminum, 5% gallium, indium, and tin. We call it 95.5. It's a solid, sitting in someone's glove hand. Here is a piece of some 50-50 weight percent aluminum with gallium, indium, and tin. And kind of an arty picture. Here's the gallium and the alloy in there. And here's the hydrogen bubbles going up a tube. Just to have a nice pretty picture out of all this stuff. Now, this is a very important slide. Gallium is frightfully expensive. $600 a kilogram. Ouch. Oh, that's a lot. You know, aluminum is $1 a kilogram. So if I need to use lots of gallium and I lost it, the game is over. I go back to making transistors. Nothing wrong with that in the first place, but this is kind of fun now. So here in this little tube, it's the gallon stand, we call it, gallium, indium, and tin. It's totally inert. It doesn't split water. It just sits there as a liquid. So this liquid, in fact, has an equilibrium freezing point of 10 degrees Celsius. You can super cool it down to minus 20 C, but that's a non-equilibrium process. So all we have to do is to centrifuge the stuff away, and we can recapture the expensive component and use it over and over and over again. That's very important in the economics of this stuff. Okay, so I wanted to show you this because this is the key feature of why this is interesting. Otherwise, you might want to use acids and bases to do the same things you can do with this. But now we can use water, which is safe. The pH stays constant. So there's nothing going on that's hazardous chemicals that you have to worry about. So what's the big deal? We think this is a technology, is a path to enable the hydrogen economy. I hope I've convinced you that there's enough aluminum to make a difference. It can make hydrogen on demand without storage or transport of hydrogen. Energy is used to make hydrogen safely and stored and transported as aluminum and generates hydrogen by splitting water. And both the aluminum and water are abundant. We can make this work with salt water. There is plenty of salt water on the planet. Aluminum, alumina, Al2O3, and these little alloy elements can be of low purity. Remember I started out the beginning of this lecture saying that the guys who are making aluminum professionally for beer cans and automobile heads and bodies, engines, they have to start with 4 nines. I can start with 2 nines or less, and it works just fine. So I can take all this scrap aluminum that's out there and use it. So at some point in time, if the same way it takes off, we can take just the aluminum oxide part and electrolyze it back to aluminum, and we've done a cost analysis of that's about 66 cents a kilogram. No external power or chemicals needed. Again, since you are electrical engineering students, anytime you have electricity, use it. Don't convert it into another form of energy. That is brain damage to do it. The problem is that the way you get electricity out of things are batteries, and they are brain damaged for trying to make electric vehicles because the energy density just is not high enough. Okay? I'll show you the numbers in a minute. This is really important. Water, I don't have to add power, so I can put this in a can and move it around. Okay, so here's one of the things we're working on right now. Charles Allen is in charge of this project. This is a high-pressure paint pot, and we have a basket in there. This is something called an X-Troll tank you can buy from Menards. It's used to keep the water from knocking in your, if you have a water system for heating. This takes as an expansion tank. It's got a membrane inside. So the way we run this thing is that we have a basket inside full of aluminum alloy. We bring in the water till the water hits the aluminum in the basket. You generate the hydrogen. The hydrogen pressure builds up and pushes the water back in the tank. So this is self-regulating. No transistors, no electronics. This is like your toilet at home. You don't even have to jiggle the handle on this one. 20 kilograms of alloy will give us 88 kilowatt hours of hydrogen. That's a lot. So this thing was just shown to work yesterday, so I got to take the boys out for some beer Friday night. And we want to put this in one of the Grand Prix cars and run around campus on hydrogen because BMW has already done the work. They have a hydrogen car with an internal combustion engine in it. There's no big deal in reconfiguring a regular gasoline car to run on hydrogen. Okay, so what about the power? We talked about energy. So we can react this stuff very rapidly. So we've done some experiments where we took a kilogram of aluminum and 1 minute to get 15.8 megajoules per minute as hydrogen. So it was 5% of the 20 kilogram charge. This converts into 250 kilowatts of hydrogen power. That's a lot. Or, if you will, a power density of 125 kilowatts per kilogram of aluminum plus water. Well, a decent small car, that's even when you're accelerating, you're not using much more than that. And when you're driving At normal speed, you're running at about 40 kilowatts. So this power is not a problem. Ah, but there are problems. Gotta be honest with you. Half of the stuff that we get out of this reaction is heat. So far, we're not doing anything with it. So to really get the 8.6 kilowatt hours per kilogram that we have stored in aluminum, we want to use the heat sometime. We haven't done that. So what we have to do in the meantime is that if we're going to generate large amounts of power, we got to manage the heat coming out of this system. And we're doing that with heat exchange devices and things like that. We have an infrastructure supply chain to manufacture the alloys. There's a company down in Lexington, Kentucky, KB Alloys, that makes this stuff for us now. And they could make a lot of it. They could make 5 million pounds a year if we needed it. But we don't have the infrastructure to really make a big dent in the transportation industry or something like that. The current energy efficiency is only 34%. That is the energy from hydrogen divided by the recycled energy needed to make aluminum back from aluminum oxide times 100 is only 34%. However, it's better by a few percentage points than doing water electrolysis, which is about 30%. You don't want to do water electrolysis in your car because that's an oxymoron. If you already have electricity, you run an electric motor. So the nice thing about this is that we're making the aluminum off-site at a plant somewhere and using it as stored energy. It's as though we were making coal from scratch. If not recycled, the weight of the needed water has to equal the weight of the alloy used, but there are schemes to do that that will keep the energy density as high as we need it. Okay, a little science, please. All right, so here's our 95-5 alloy. We've taken a backscattered electron photomicrograph of this material, and what I want to show you here is if you can see this, there are regions that are white. This is indium and tin. Indium and tin are insoluble in aluminum. So when you cool the melt down and get grains of this stuff, here's a grain roughly right about, this would be a grain, about 50 microns. All this indium and tin segregates at the grain boundary. It takes a little bit of gallium with it. So what we really have here is we have aluminum with some gallium in it that gets put into the crystal. The solubility of gallium and aluminum is a maximum of 20%. And since we start with only 3% gallium, the grains have a lot less in it. But at the grain boundaries, we have tin and indium there and some gallium. What this means is the grain boundaries have a melting point of this alloy well below room temperature. So, how does it work? Well, my student Jeff Zeebart's working on that. We are not positive yet, but we think what happens is that the liquid gallium, indium, tin in the grain boundaries continually dissolves the aluminum. You bring in the water, just like in the early IBM experiment, you get hydrogen, aluminum oxide, gets swept away in the water. The reaction continues on until all the aluminum has been dissolved into the grain boundaries and gone. That's what happens experimentally, and we're trying to prove that because this is Jeff's thesis, that this is the process that's going on. And so far, we haven't seen any data that says that he's wrong about that. What about some kinetics? Well, here are some reaction moles of hydrogen produced versus time as a function of temperature. There's a little delay time here, then it gets going, and then after you use it all up, or most of it, it turns over and saturates. So it's an S-curve kind of thing. This is early data. We're continually refining this, but the message here is the higher the temperature, the faster it goes. So it turns out, if you get above 60 degrees C and maybe steam, we can make bombs with this stuff if we need to, a rocket propellant perhaps. So there are all kinds of applications that could come out of this, but this just shows you what the preliminary data that we're getting for the reaction kinetics of this material. Now let's do the fun part. So we sat around thinking about this because this is easier to do than doing real experiments in the laboratory. You can sit down, think about it. So there are there's a range of applications. So we think this stuff would be pretty good in computers. Replace the heavy battery that's in your laptop. I know I got a heavy battery in mine. So we could put a fuel cell in there and the aluminum in there and reduce the weight and still get the number of the energy density that we need, namely, say, 10 watt hours or so for a PDA or a laptop or iPods. So we call these the small scale applications, 1 to 100 milliwatts. The medium things would be from 1 to 200 kilowatts. That would be 200 kilowatts would be cars, and 10,000 kilowatts would be boats, submarines, whatever. We would use it for trains. We use it for supplemental power. And the large stuff would be for trains. These are small boats and cars for this range. So what I meant to say is that this is the energy, so you need a lot of energy storage to be able to run a car 500 miles, or 300 miles rather, but you need a power range from one kilowatt for a little scooter to 200 kilowatts for a BMW that lays rubber when you push down the accelerator. So the large applications, we're talking about 5,000 kilowatts and well over a million kilowatt hours. So this would be for trains, ships, subs, off-grid community power, base load, peak power demand, storage for wind and solar power. There's a lot of people who want to use wind and solar energy to do electrolysis of hydrogen. Brain damage. What are you going to do with the hydrogen as a storage material? You got to put it in a tank, put it in 10,000 PSI tanks, put it on a train and watch it go boom? Not me. I want to make aluminum with my electricity. All right? So this really makes sense. If I have a solar farm, you know, if you've ever measured the solar intensity at midnight, it's less than a nanowatt per square centimeter. That's not very much power. During the day, the best you're going to do is 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. Okay, so wind is power. Both these are power. They're called solar energy. The solar energy actually sits away at 93 million miles away. That's the energy. The stuff we get is in the form of power during the day. If you're out extraterrestrial, you can get it all the time you want. And wind is also sometimes, it's dynamic. So when you have wind and solar power, convert it to stored energy. And to my knowledge, I don't think people have found a way to use wind and solar power to make coal. Maybe that's a good thing. Okay, so here, let's get example applications. Clearly, I will show you the data in a minute. Replace batteries with gallium aluminum hydrogen / fuel cell systems for high energy density electric power applications. So here are some other things. There's a guy down in Indianapolis who's formed a little company called Algalco. He is trying to make emergency / standby power units that have our aluminum in it. So the aluminum is, will sit there forever, not doing anything. Gasoline will turn to shellac after 6 months. So the idea here is you have this thing in an environment where a medical patient needs it. So there are 65,000 customers in Indiana, medically fragile customers, I guess is the PC thing, where if the grid should go down, four or five guys from Duke Electric and the other REMCOs show up with some emergency power unit, and each of these guys is getting $100 an hour. So if we had installed it with these customers, something that would switch on and give us give us hydrogen, it goes into an internal combustion energy, then runs a dynamo, then we can run refrigerators, we can run the oxygen unit, and supply the emergency power much more inexpensively than what is done now. So there's some interest in the REMCOs in this stuff. Electric wheelchairs, golf carts, makes sense. PDAs, laptops, I've already mentioned that. Hybrid cars, efficient internal combustion energy cars. So they keep talking about getting to 100 miles per gallon for an internal combustion engine. Well, if they get there, we don't need very much aluminum. We need only about 20 kilograms of aluminum to run the car 300 miles with that kind of efficiency. I am interested in doing Stirling engines. Now, if you folks have never heard of a Stirling engine, this is basically something where you have a hot tip and a cold rejection tip. You heat it up one end. You piston heats the working fluid, and the heat hits heats up the working fluid and drives the piston down, dumps it out, comes back. That's a Stirling engine. Sometimes it's called an external combustion engine style. The Phillips company developed some of these things. They never got to the marketplace, but they are very interesting because you can use both the hydrogen directly to supply the heat or the heat from the reaction. So I'm trying to get one of these things to do some experiments on. They're very hard to find in the research size, research laboratory size. Range extenders. I'm going to talk about the GM Volt, which is supposed to come out in 2010. If GM doesn't die this week, it's not clear if they won't, but let's suppose that they will, we'll talk about. Liquid fuel multiplier, so you can put hydrogen into diesel and increase its efficiency and get rid of soot and the nitrous oxide emissions. Train subs and trucks, I've already talked about. Large boats and other maritime applications. This one really turns me on. Desalinate potable water. Okay, suppose we have this village somewhere deep in the jungle. There are no roads. There's no electricity. Yet someone has managed to drop in a laptop and a TV or two. How are you going to power this thing? Well, we're going to drop in our little aluminum package. The swamp water is not potable, so they're going to go over. They're going to take the swamp water out. They're going to put it next to the aluminum. Out comes the hydrogen. We're going to collect some of the hydrogen. After we collect it, and we're going to use it to create power or electricity. The product of all that is semiconductor-grade water, which you can drink. So you get a twofer out of it. You get power plus potable water, all airlifted in to a village. What does it cost? It's expensive, $2.50 a gallon. But if you have no roads and if you're trying to put a military operation in someplace, when you have to drive trucks in full of water and stuff and create a road, that's very expensive. So I think this has a really good chance of making a big impact in the pure water, remote power issue. There's this thing called hydrogen filling stations, which is brain damaged. But if they're going to do it, we could make the hydrogen at the filling station on demand for the guy who comes in and wants to pipe in hydrogen, 10,000 PSI. Okay, I don't want to be there. But heck, we could put our aluminum in there and use the water nearby, and we'd get electricity out of it to run the Coke machine thing next to it. So it actually makes sense for that. Okay, here's the battery story, guys. All right? We're almost done. So let's look at the energy density of batteries. Well, the thing we still use to start most of our cars, 31 to 51 watt-hours per kilogram. Remember, I was talking about 8.6 kilowatt-hours per kilogram for aluminum. Lithium ion, really sexy. There is a Tesla car out there that's going to have $60,000 worth of batteries in it. and $10,000 worth of charm or sex appeal. It turns out they can't make any money that way, so they're going to have to sell them for $140,000. 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, and you can go 80 miles. All right. So look at the energy density. At best, about 120 kilowatt hours per kilogram, better than lead acid, but they're using small batteries, and they're wiring together 3,000 of these things for the power supply for the car. If any one of them shorts out and you're in the car, well, I just hope your insurance policy is paid up, that's all. Okay. Nickel metal hydride, the Prius. The Prius is actually a pretty good model because of the way it works, because it runs a dynamo from the internal combustion engine. It's not too bad. It's not as good as lithium ions, but they're using nickel metal hydride for the Prius. Let's take our stuff, worst case. We will get 340 watt hours per kilogram. The Gibbs energy is the lower one energy for fuel cells. So the GM guys tell me, even with the weight of the fuel cells, we still beat lithium ion by a factor of 2 or 3. So this number of 1340 watt hours includes the weight of the water, a 70% efficiency factor for fuel cells, which is not unreasonable, but not the container or fuel cell weight. So the energy density is much greater than 1, including the weight of the high-power fuel cell. So if I look at this number, I compare ED of this versus the energy density of a lead-acid battery, that's 26. So lead-acid batteries are not even in the running for mobile applications, unless it's for a golf cart, which they're used. They weigh 450 pounds to run you 4 hours around the golf cart. It's a factor of 7, even for lithium ions. So as the guys at GM told us, we should be able to own the battery business if we do this right. Okay, here's another fly in the ointment. Good old Department of Energy has decreed that by 2015, the onboard hydrogen energy density has to be 9%. So a bunch of car guys got together and said, what's a big enough number so they'll never make it? They gave this to the board of directors of DOE, and they put this on the roadmap. The best we could possibly do with ours, I'm not going to go through the numbers, I'm just going to tell you, we can get an average density by recycling the water of 6.5%. So this was better than the 2010 goal, but I can't get any funding from it because when I talked to them on the phone, they said, well, we can show that you can't make the 2015 roadmap goal. So I said, okay, but who can? Oh, nobody can, but there are a lot of professors out there who tell us they can have a path to that. So I said, well, what happens if they don't make it? Well, we just stop their funding, that's all. The message to your students is, be sure you make a proposal that's on the roadmap, even if it won't work, if you want to get funding. I know that's cruel, but that's a true statement. So we don't have a high energy density as far as the DOE goals, but it works. Let me say a little bit about the electrochemistry, because that's the important part of recycling aluminum oxide. So basically, it's an Al3, and the aluminum oxide plus 3 electrons gives you elemental aluminum. That takes about 12.9 kilowatt hours per kilogram, or at a present efficiency of 67%, okay? That's actually pretty good. In the laboratory, but not in the field, they've gotten efficiencies as high as 95%, and they can do it with inert electrodes. The things that you buy that are made of aluminum now are made by the Hall process. Electrolysis is done with carbon, and one of the reaction products is a small amount of carbon dioxide that comes out, which if you're going to be green, you've got to sequester it at some point in time, but nobody's worried about it yet. So let's use an example for our aluminum thing. 2.9 kilograms of aluminum will produce the same amount of energy in the form of hydrogen. It's 1 kilogram of gasoline. which is about 12.8 kilowatt hours. Let's take a Prius, which is pretty good. 7.5 gallons times 2.7 kilograms per gallon equals 20 kilograms of gasoline to drive a Prius 300 miles. If I use aluminum, I'm going to need 59 kilograms, and I'm going to need 24 kilograms of onboard water because I'm going to recycle the water in the Prius, and that's allowed, actually. So at $3.50 a gallon of gasoline, yeah, it's cheaper now, but remember last August it was $4. And $2.40 a kilogram for aluminum, the trip costs about $26 using gasoline and $140 using aluminum. Ouch. But if I put my aluminum recycler right next to a nuclear power plant, the on-site power production cost is 2 cents a kilowatt hour. So the aluminum can be recycled back to aluminum for 26 cents a kilogram of aluminum if I do it that way. So if I do 2.9 kilograms of aluminum production cost is about 76 cents or $15 for the trip. At $3.50 a gallon gasoline retail, 1 kilogram of gasoline costs $1.30 or $26 for the trip. For equal energy as hydrogen, aluminum can be cheaper than gasoline, so it's all about supply chain and infrastructure and how you do this. And I've already showed you that from a sustainability point of view, there are no issues about the amount of aluminum. We're suggesting aluminum recycling could be done with wind or photovoltaic farms, which would be very nice. The aluminum smelter, let me point this out. We do get a CO2 off of this thing, but it's about a third of that compared to the CO2 coming from burning gasoline. The difference is that when you're driving a car down the road, you're not likely going to sequester that CO or CO2. But just like the coal guys are supposed to be doing, we could sequester the CO2 on site since the smelter is not moving down the road yet. I don't envision it will be. But let's take a look at that's interesting. Okay, so only if we had a reliable fuel cell. Suppose we could magically make a 150 kilowatt fuel cell for only $10 a kilowatt. Wouldn't that be nice? GM thinks they can do it. I don't believe they will, but that's okay. So if we go through the numbers there, and I won't go through each line, 24 cents a kilowatt times 30 kilograms, I can do this whole trip with a fuel cell car for 300 miles wholesale at $7.20 for a 300-mile trip. So there would be a great incentive for me, at least, if someone could make a very reliable fuel cell that high power fuel cells for a reasonable cost. Right now it's $1,000 per kilowatt right now, which is way too much money. So let me show you a couple other, let me tell you the GM Volt model. Let's assume they'll be in business. The government's going to rescue them, right? So let's take a 40 kilowatt internal combustion engine. I have verified these numbers with them. This is what the Volt's going to have. It's going to be tuned for hydrogen at efficiency of 60 miles per gallon equivalent to drive a generator as the batteries run out. Remember, the Volt is an EV hybrid car. What that means is they have enough batteries in there to drive this car 40 miles. And that 40-mile number came from getting statistics of the average commute of the American worker, which was 33 miles. Now, they probably didn't do it in Indiana because some of us live further away than that. So they probably averaged in New York where you walk three feet to your office. I don't know what they did, but the number was 33 miles per day for commuting to work and back. So that's the number we use. The EV part, they're going to have a battery that will last 40 miles, and then overnight you're going to plug it in, go to sleep, and recharge your battery. run again. So what they're worried about is that suppose you decide you're not going to drive home right away. You're going to go over to Chumley's for some dogfish ale and some buffalo wings. And you forget in your engine, you didn't turn the electricity off. So you get to take us on zero. So now you're SOL, as they say. But to the rescue, GM has an internal combustion engine in there that's going to produce 40 kilowatts of power so you can get home. Just like these, for those of you who have these cars with these little donut tires, you get a flat, it gets you home. And if you have run flat tires, you can go 50 miles an hour for 50 miles or so to get to the dealer and get your tire fixed or a new one. So that's the model. So here we go. So if we take their, these are the numbers they said it's going to be, 13 kilowatt hours of hydrogen needed to drive 20 miles. So I'm going to have a spare amount of fuel for the internal combustion engine, not using gasoline, but aluminum to make hydrogen. 3 kilograms of alloy will generate the needed hydrogen alloy, need the hydrogen, the alloy contained in a canister. So, you know, 3 kilograms is only 7 pounds, or a little less than 7 pounds. So we're going to plug this into a fixture in the trunk. So I'm going to take 3 kilograms of water hosed into the gasoline filler port that would have been the gasoline filler port, the canister exchange. So once we use the 3 kilograms up because we go to Chumley's, take a detour, and we don't have enough electrons to get home, so we're going to exchange the canister at a convenience store, Walmart's, car dealers, etc. The spent canisters are sent back to the aluminum refineries, the recharge and return to the distributor. The neat thing about this is that GM's internal business model doesn't have to be part of the supply chain for the standby power. Remember, the Volt design is for EV with a backup to get you home in case you run out of electrons before you plug back in. Okay, so let me show you a nice little... So Joe has this guy working in his group, I guess dates this young lady. So here's a canister. I understand they went over, knocked on the door, and this guy nearly freaked out when we wanted to take the hose, the water hose, up to his regular car. Of course, we didn't turn it on. So she's going to put this canister back in the place in the trunk so we can use it for standby hydrogen if we need it. So we put in the right amount of water into the water tank now. It's not a gasoline tank. And so on the dashboard of your car, you will have the hydrogen meter. So if you had to use it and it's on empty, you got to take it back to the dealer. The battery meter is on full in this particular case. So here's this gal taking the canister back to Pep Boys or AutoZone and exchanging it for a replacement. Okay, so this actually would work very nicely. Of course, GM yawned over this thing because they're hurting. You know, these guys are really in bad shape. In fact, their delivery dates that they're projecting for the Volt is 2010. And so they actually were going to show one of these Volt models to a couple of congressmen who were supposed to go out there to see if their recovery plan looked intelligent or not. So this is the first GM EV hybrid, totally green car. No gasoline in it anymore, just aluminum. Infrastructure, distributed, diverse, in place. Alcoa, Walmart's, convenience stores, gasoline. GM does not have to be part of the supply chain and have it part of their internal business model. Current Volt models hasn't changed. Go to the website. Still 40-mile range using batteries. Auxiliary power used as a backup. So the trouble with having gasoline as the backup, this stuff turns into shellac after 6 months. So if you're a real good guy and you don't use the gasoline, you're going to get up some morning and your gasoline tank is going to be full of shellac. It is hard to remove shellac. Okay, let me talk about one more example. One of the interesting things, actually two. One of the two things about, how are we doing? I got till 4:15, right? Is that true? Okay, I'll whip it on out here. So this model is taking the hydrogen and enriching diesel fuel by about 15%. This supposedly, according to blog sites, notice I have this caveat, not a vetted number, but according to blog sites, this increases the efficiency of the diesel. Furthermore, there's something called Blue Tech that Daimler had invented to get rid of the soot. It's a little box that catches the soot that comes out of a diesel engine, and there's also the problem with NOx, nitrous oxide. So I was going to make this setup so we would change the canister for enriching diesel stuff. We're only going to do it 15%. Anyway, it becomes a freebie because what you add in the cost of the aluminum, you get back as efficiency. But as I said, this is not a vetted number, but it's something we should look at. This will be hard to see. This is one of my favorite models. So right now, trains are diesel electric. So we have a diesel engine turning a dynamo to supply electricity to an electric motor. And as all of you know, when a train is standing still, you have to change a lot of MV to get it up to speed. So if I only had a diesel engine with a clutch, it would run once and the clutch would burn out. So that's why electric motors have maximum torque at 0 RPM. You all know that. So that's why diesel electric was invented back in the 30s, well before I was born, and well before most of your parents were born, probably. So anyway, so the idea here is let's get rid of the diesel part and do it with hydrogen and steam through a closed loop turbine system, closed loop turbine. And we'd have a tank of our aluminum, 60,000 gallons, a tank of water. So when we use all this stuff after a long period of time, the train just rolls the tanks back into the aluminum factory, Alcoa, and takes on new tanks. So there's no problem of exchanging the spent fuel. The numbers get very interesting, though. So we could have over 666 days of a continuous generation using this model. And the neat thing about trains is that once they go from 0 to 60 in 10 minutes rather than 10.4 seconds. But once they're on level track and moving, the rolling friction is very small. So it doesn't take a large engine to move lots of weight around. That's why truckers put the trailer parts of trucks on cars. So this is a really good thing. The aluminum becomes almost free if you do this. Two other things. Here is the enabling wind and solar as base load or peak load capacity. The idea here is to get the target cost down to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. We're going to recycle the alloy 40 times. No big deal. We can do that. All required technologies are known. So it's primarily an engineering development project, which is good. Enables environmentally sound, secure electricity. So what is it? Here's the flow chart. Here's our reaction tank at a utilities. So we send out hydrogen, 4.4 kilowatt hours per kilogram, 24/7 or on demand. We run into a fuel cell or turbine gas generator, or we take the heat and run that through a steam turbine. So we supply electricity, so we get both cogeneration out of it. So then we take the reaction product, aluminum. We separate out the components, namely the gallium and even tin. We then electrolyze the aluminum oxide. This is all on the plant site now because you can do that. So we use either solar or wind. We recover this stuff. We make the alloy again, put it back in the reaction tank, and there we have a system that could be used by the utilities. Let me move on. So no big deal with the gallium. I won't stop on this. There's plenty of gallium. If I have less than 5% gallium, there's enough gallium out there to run 10 to the ninth cars, a billion cars. So it's low purity. Okay, so I won't spend any time on this. I just want to show you a bottom line. Cost per kilowatt versus the number of recycles. Remember, the things that we're recycling is the aluminum oxide, which is more or less a fixed cost. But this thing keeps going down as a result of recycling the expensive gallium, indium, and tin. So when you get up to about here, you get less than 10 cents a kilowatt hour out of this stuff. So it costs 10 cents a kilowatt hour to make the fuel if you recycle the alloy enough times, and that's not a big deal. Finally, if you want to see the cycle, here we have the energy source. We make the aluminum alloy. We sequester the CO2. We add the water. We get the reaction, aluminum oxide, back to the energy source. We get heat. We get hydrogen. We go into the application. Out of the application, we always get water, energy back again, so we can recycle this water around. So this is what the cycle looks like for the reaction cycle. And my last slide. So here is a possible supply chain infrastructure. So let's start up with the upper left corner. Electrolysis of the aluminum via the Hall process. So now we have aluminum bars, pellets, whatever. We can send it down oil lines. It doesn't react with oil. Now we take it to the fuel assembly. So we make the alloy right near where we're going to sell to the customer. So we can ship this aluminum by trains, trucks, ships, or pipelines. So then we give this to a distributor. The fuel is taken to a depot in Lafayette. You can use the hydrogen directly, or you can tail it for an application. So then once you've done that, you send the stuff out to the customer that they want. You send the spent fuel back down the line. We either separate into components, or we actually leave the gallium, indium, and tin and do the process again. So that's what a supply chain cycle would look like, and there doesn't seem to be any problem with that. And my last slide. So we don't think there's any technical showstoppers in this. Just haven't found any yet. There's plenty of aluminum, and it's cheap. Those are important. And you can recycle the expensive component, namely the alloy. But there are plenty of barriers to realize it. The worst one is our U.S. government, and I'll say it out loud in this room. You should write DOE and your congressman a letter to change the roadmap so that guys who are making only 6% mass density have a chance to move the process along with your taxpayer dollars. Fossil fuel and motor vehicle industry, guys who are making gasoline aren't going to lie down and die. They're the incumbents. Just like silicon is going to be here forever. And we're going to need $100 billion needed to build the infrastructure. So those are barriers. With that, thank you for listening.
Okay. I'm going to see if there's one question, and then I'll ask you to chat with Jerry afterwards if there are other questions. Anybody? Right here.
I'm sorry, what? A little bit louder. Oh, so, okay, so who owns the patent? Well, there are several patents involved. The original one has expired from IBM. Okay, that was where we used liquid gallium with just a little bit of aluminum, okay? Expired. Purdue has a patent on this that was in the process. It was put into the patent office a couple of years ago, so they're still processing it. Purdue owns the IP on that. Okay? And we just submitted another one on the reaction tank that I showed in the slide. All right? Purdue owns both of those. Anybody else? Yeah?
Last question. Have you tried other stuff other than aluminum, like other metals?
Yes. We're trying to make silicon work because the energy density is higher. So far, we haven't got it to work yet. The unique thing is that the gallium, or being able to dissolve the reactant into a solvent, seems to be critical to this process and having it be liquid. So we're searching still. I'll even try gold silicon because even though gold's expensive, if we get liquid, it may react with hydrogen, with water very nicely. We just haven't tried it yet.
So I think one of the interesting things about your talk is how, as engineers, when you get involved in proposing new technology, it all boils down to economics.
Right. Oh, that's my bottom line. So if you're going to do something, make sure at the end of the day, it should be for fun along the way, but make sure it has a chance of getting there, because otherwise it's just a thesis on a shelf somewhere.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jerry.